Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza on this pre-recorded program via remote from Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Monday, October 19, 2020. A Sudanese lawyer is asking the transitional government in Sudan to hand over former President Omar al-Bashir to the ICC.
And also to seek cooperation with respect to the rest of the arrest warrants that have been issued in the situation in Darfur.
And Kenya is experiencing a second wave of COVID-19.
What is worrying is actually our political leadership that seems not to be adhering to the laid down guidelines that have been given by the Ministry of Health.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. A senior Sudanese lawyer is calling on the transitional government in Sudan to hand over former President Omar al-Bashir and some of his officials accused of war crimes in Darfur to the International Criminal Court. The chief prosecutor of ICC, Fatou Bensouda, is currently visiting Sudan to discuss the prosecution of Sudanese militia leader Ali Kosheb, who handed himself over and is currently on trial in Hague. For VOA News, Nabil Biagio reports from Washington.
ICC Chief Prosecutor Fatou Bensouda and other ICC officials arrived in Khartoum over the weekend. It's the first visit by ICC officials to Sudan since the court began working on charges of genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity committed against civilians in Darfur. Addressing the press yesterday, Bensouda called her visit to Sudan historic.
And our main purpose for coming here is to seek cooperation with the current authorities of the Sudan to discuss the case that has already is about to start, and also to seek cooperation with respect to the rest of the arrest warrants that have been issued in the situation in Darfur, Sudan.
In 2009 and 2010, the ICC issued two arrest warrants for then-President Omar al-Bashir on multiple counts of genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity committed in Darfur between 2003 and 2008 during a counterinsurgency campaign by his government. Other arrest warrants were issued for three top political and military officials in the Bashir administration and a rebel commander from Darfur. In June, senior militia commander Ali Kosheb surrendered himself to authorities in neighboring Central African Republic and was transferred to The Hague to stand trial for 50 counts of war crimes and crimes against humanity committed in Darfur. Bashir and two top former officials, Abdurrahim Hussein and Ahmed Haroun, are in a Khartoum prison after being found guilty of various corruption charges. One rebel leader from Darfur, Abdullah Banda, who was also indicted by the ICC, remains at large. Bensouda says her visit to Sudan aims to bring justice to the victims in Darfur.
We are meeting with the authorities, the relevant authorities, and we are speaking with them, and we are trying to find a way of how we can have a meaningful engagement to be able to advance this case that has been with the ICC now for over a decade. This is the main purpose of my presence here in the Sudan, and to emphasize the importance of having justice. Justice especially for the victims in Darfur.
Khartoum-based Saleh Mahmoud is the president of the Darfur Bar Association. He says Bashir's ouster in 2019 brought an opportunity to achieve justice for the victims of war crimes in Darfur.
After the revolution of December, hopes of victims revived because they thought in the absence of Bashir, the transitional government should be more understanding the importance of justice and accountability, fighting impunity, because all the perpetrators who are implicated in the commission of horrible crimes in Darfur are still beyond the reach of justice. On their head is Omar al-Bashir and the other individuals.
Mahmoud says Sudan's transitional government must be true to its word and fully cooperate with the ICC by handing over Bashir and the other accused individuals for whom the ICC has issued arrest warrants.
The victims are waiting to see that the government should be credible to fulfill its commitments. They stated that they are ready to cooperate with the court. This is now becoming obvious that, yes, the meetings of yesterday and of today possibly will make it more clear if the government is really serious about its commitment. And I think victims are waiting to hear good news that, yes, it's all about the surrender of Omar Bashir and other accused to the ICC in The Hague, not in Sudan or any other place.
Although the recently signed peace agreement between Sudan's transitional government and various rebel groups provides for justice for victims of war crimes in Darfur, Mahmoud doubts that any court set up in Sudan will achieve real justice. He says Sudan still has laws that are inconsistent with international law. Mahmoud also says the political environment in Sudan does not guarantee witness protection for credible and transparent tribunals to take place. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Washington.
African diaspora organizers say the U.S. 2020 election is drawing more African-born immigrants eligible to vote, but some argue that they are not organized enough to constitute a voting bloc relative to other immigrant communities in the United States. Salim Solomon Fedaku reports.
The African diaspora in the United States is mobilizing voter drives as organizers believe 2020 is a time for these voters to flex their political muscles as never before. Nika Achapu is the founder of the African Public Affairs Committee, a nonpartisan political organization that advocates policies for the empowerment of the African diaspora.
Our goal is to empower people into learning that they have a voice, they have a say in the policies, in the laws that are actually brought forth and are affecting us as Africans living in this country.
According to the latest U.S. Census figures, in 2018, there were over 2 million foreign-born Africans in the country. Overall, 50.6% of immigrants are naturalized citizens and 94.4% are 18 years old or older and likely have voting rights. But the diverse and dispersed nature of the population in the U.S. makes it hard for African voters to organize, although there are concentrated population centers in several cities, including Minneapolis, Washington, D.C., Houston, and New York City, the African diaspora does not speak with a single voice. There are no definitive surveys as to the political leanings of African diaspora, says John Campbell, a senior fellow for Africa Policy Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington, D.C.
They are not big enough or organized enough to constitute a voting bloc. Unlike some other ethnic identities in the United States.
But organizers say concerns of U.S. voters of African descent aren't much different than the U.S. population at large, the economy, education, healthcare, and security. Because many African immigrants work in frontline roles, the COVID-19 response is a major concern.
A lot of our African diaspora members are in the trenches and working. Whether it's in the medical field, whether it's in transporting people, whether it's bagging groceries, we are pretty much everywhere.
And the power of voters from the African diaspora appears to be growing. Between 2010 and 2018, the sub-Saharan Africa population in the U.S. increased by 52%. On a national level, several African politicians have made waves. In 2018, Representative Ilhan Omar of Minnesota became the first Somali-American elected to Congress, and Representative Joe Neguse of Colorado, born in the U.S. to Eritrean parents, became the first person of Eritrean origin elected to Congress. A study by the Pew Research Center showed that, contrary to stereotypes, African immigrants to the U.S. on average are more likely to be college educated and employed than the population at large.
I think that it's very hard to pigeonhole them. that like Americans in general, they will vote for whichever candidate personally appeals to them the most.
But one issue voters of African descent are particularly concerned about is immigration, organizers say. Many came as immigrants or have family members that have immigrated to the country. Each year, tens of thousands of Africans are admitted to the U.S. as refugees, escaping places like the Democratic Republic of Congo, Somalia, and Eritrea. Because of this, Africans are particularly concerned with recent changes to the immigration system, restricting numbers of immigrants. In 2016, the U.S. admitted nearly 85,000 refugees, including 31,000 from Africa. In 2020, the U.S. will admit a total of 18,000 refugees and 15,000 in 2021. The U.S. State Department says the reduction reaffirms America's enduring commitment to assist the world's most vulnerable people while fulfilling our first duty to protect and serve the American people. Sam Fanti, a Washington, D.C.-based political strategist who is organizing a voter drive in Georgia and Kentucky to register immigrant citizens, said recent U.S. policies, like a travel ban that has cut off immigrant visas to several African countries and highly publicized deportations of Africans, are galvanizing voters.
They feel the need to go out and vote now in order to protect themselves and their families. Many African families have been here for 2, 3, 4, or even more generations. And so they feel like their children and their children's children need to be protected now. And so they are now galvanizing support from one another in their communities to register to vote in order to defeat and change some of those policies now.
Some South Sudanese football fans and activists have cautiously welcomed the resumption of construction at the Juba Stadium. Some of the football fans and activists say the Ministry of Youth and Sports should give a comprehensive report of an investigation into what caused the collapse of a section of the stadium 2 weeks ago. For VOA News, Wake Simon Wudu reports from Juba.
South Sudan's Youth and Sports Minister Albino Bol says after a government investigative committee reported the cause of the stadium's partial roof collapse last Friday, Bol ordered the construction to resume.
The committee presented its final report on my office yesterday evening, wherein they came to a conclusion that the incident was caused as a result of the following factors. One, overloading of the formwork support due to disturbance by impact of nodules. Two, collision of shooter with the formwork support and mechanical fault of pump machine.
A reinforced concrete roofing slab at the Juba National Football Stadium collapsed October 6, prompting Bol to suspend construction work at the site. Bol called the partial roof collapse a minor accident which involved a faulty pump machine.
From the fact and evidence gathered, the committee has arrived at a conclusion that the incident was a minor accident caused as a result of human error.
Bol says he ordered the contractors to be more careful as they resume work on the stadium over the weekend.
The contractor to take maximum precautionary measures to avoid the occurrence of such incidences.
A grader levels the ground while construction workers cut iron bars and timber while others pack their materials near the collapsed part. Emmanuel Yokwe is the resident engineer at the stadium construction site.
Place where the incident happened, they are trying to rectify the place, to fix the place back. So they are working on the formwork right now.
Girma Sifero, the manager of GS Construction, the company contracted to build the stadium, says workers are being more careful to avoid similar accidents from occurring in the future.
You need to give maximum precaution when you are doing such things. Because, you know, sometimes we have casters 3,000 meter cube and what has failed was 12.4 meter cube. Maybe, you know, the engineers now, the project engineer, the site engineers, everybody, the foremans, now they will take maximum precaution measures.
football fans have cautiously welcomed the resumption of work on the stadium. Youth activist Peter Malir, a big fan of South Sudan's The Bright Stars, says although he wants to see the stadium's construction completed, the partial roof collapse highlights the government's bad procurement policies, which he says do not produce quality work.
The government should have put more efforts to investigate more. You know what really happened? You know, they call it minor. They call it a minor issue. But this determines, this is symbolic. This project is symbolic to the nation. It is the first project. So if such have happened, this will have taken, you know, the committee will have taken longer time than what we see.
South Sudan will not be able to host international football matches until the work is completed, which is scheduled for February. Work began in July of last year. Yokwe says the new stadium will have an international standard great turf, players' workout rooms, a sauna, around 30 washrooms, and a medical clinic. Once completed, the stadium is expected to host 7,000 spectators. For VOA News, I'm Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, Kenya is experiencing a second wave of COVID-19 infections. That story is coming up right after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what would you most likely to accomplish in life, and how close are you to achieving it?
My dream is to be one of the best filmmakers in Uganda and maybe in the world at large. With time and what I've done so far to achieve that, yes, I know I'm still very far, but I've written some scripts already.
To me, as a software developer, I still have a long way, but hopefully, God, I'll be able to make it.
I want to be a voice for the people who I meet and help people generally wherever I find myself, and I think that studying to become a lawyer is in the right direction to achieving that.
I would like to be a very, very great musician, a composer. For now, I'm not close there, but I'm working to get to the level I can actually achieve that.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. Kenya is facing a second wave of COVID-19 infections just weeks after lifting tough restrictions meant to limit the spread of the virus. Kenya's Health Cabinet Secretary, Mutahi Kagwe, on Sunday warned the country was headed to tough times after reporting more than 600 new cases and several deaths. David Ogindi is the presiding bishop of Christ is the Answer Ministries. During the COVID-19 pandemic, he was appointed by the government as a member of the National Interreligious Council to give guidance and develop protocol for operations of religious places of worship. He talks with VOA's Peter Clotty about the current situation in the country, including conspiracy theories surrounding the pandemic.
We had a partial reopening in July, where the government allowed a maximum of 100 people to attend any place of worship irrespective of the capacity. Then come August 18th, that was adjusted so that people then could attend according to the capacity of their facility, but ensuring they have a 1.5 meter distance between them or 5 feet between them. In the congregation, they have to wear masks, they have to wash their hands, and the service has to be a maximum of 1.5 hours. So that has persisted up to now. So really, people are free to go to their places of worship, but that means that the capacity has been drastically reduced, with most places taking no more than 10 to 15% of their normal capacity.
Well, Bishop, you've been part of the team advising the government on the safe and phased reopening of places of worship. Are you currently satisfied with the measures being put in place or implemented to combat the spread of the disease?
By and large, in terms of the places of worship, there has been very good compliance We estimate up to 95% of the various places of worship, whether churches or mosques or temples, have adhered to the regulations and guidelines that have been given by the Interfaith Council, which was charged with the responsibility of developing these guidelines. I'm a member of that, and we have traveled around the country monitoring how things are going. We have set up committees in different regions of the country, and they give us reports of how things are going on. And generally, we are quite happy with what is happening within the places of worship. What is worrying is actually our political leadership that seems not to be adhering to the laid down guidelines that have been given by the Ministry of Health.
Bishop, your concerns were replicated or backed by some civil society organizations. They urge religious leaders like yourself to lean on the government or some of these political leaders to abide by the laid down regulations in order to curb the spread of this disease. So far, what has been the response from the church mother bodies or religious groups?
Indeed, we have tried our best to call on the government. We have appealed even up to the president level that people should adhere to the laid down guidelines so that we curb the spread of the virus. Unfortunately, we are in that season where there's a bit of heightened political division within our political leadership. And so they are very keen on finding places where they can air their views and talk to the public. And so these kinds of situations really causes them not to seem to care too much about what is happening or what could happen. But we continue to appeal and we continue to put pressure. We have seen some indications that at least a section of the political leadership is listening to that, but we are yet to see good response from a majority of them.
Bishop, there's some misconceptions surrounding this virus. Some people suggest that perhaps this was meant to prevent worshippers or churchgoers or those who go to the mosque or religious people from congregating in one place. Others are saying, well, this is a medical issue that has to be addressed medically. What are some of the misconceptions that you are confronting in Kenya?
It is true that there's a lot of misconception, a lot of conspiracy theories. Really, at the beginning of the pandemic, there was a lot of information, sad to say, flowing from particularly the United States and parts of Europe as to the real cause and source of this disease. There was quite a bit of confusion created by people, significant people who said this virus does not actually exist, is a fake thing, it is not real. And so that created a bit of confusion. So whereas people were afraid of this virus, in fact, Africans in general were terribly afraid that should this thing come into our continent, people will be dying with the millions, considering what we had seen happening in places like Spain, in Italy, and later in the US and other parts of the world.
That's Bishop David Ogindi, the presiding bishop of Christ is the Answer Ministries. He spoke to my colleague Peter Clotty. The spread of misinformation makes the search for trustworthy news that much harder. As Tina Trainer reports, tech companies are identifying media bias and helping readers discern the real news from the fake ones.
Between Google, Facebook, Twitter, and other ways Americans get their news online, many may be experiencing information overload in the run-up to Election Day. And some information isn't necessarily accurate or even true.
8 in 10 Americans are now concerned that misinformation will play a role in the outcome of the election.
But would most Americans be able to spot misinformation if they saw it?
We are expecting the news consumer to actually do the work and recognize, is this news true? Is this biased? Is it not?
That's why Harleen Kaur and her co-founders started Ground News, which claims to be the world's first news comparison platform.
So say it's a political story about elections, we'll show you how all the way from far left to far right are covering it so you can compare.
Ground News's browser extension provides this immediately for stories.
With a single click, you can then figure out what else is available. What are the other spins on the same story?
We are all biased. We're biased by everything we know, by our life experience, and everything we don't know.
John Gable is the co-founder of AllSides.com, a site that provides media bias ratings and identifies left, center, and right takes on the headlines.
We automatically bring out different points of view. So our first three results of any search you do on a news story will give you three different perspectives on that same topic.
User experience researchers like Samir Patil have found that any additional guidance can help reduce the spread of misinformation.
And this doesn't have to be very lengthy or extensive, just a short blurb that says this might be questionable or you might want to look further into it. Just that brief intervention acts as a check and reduces people's tendency or intention to share it.
Ultimately, a healthy dose of skepticism is needed.
Just at least think about, is this likely to be true? Are there factors that may make it not true? Just that brief pause and reflecting, it might be useful here.
This election season and beyond, it's one way to separate the real news from the fake news. Tina Trin, VOA News, New York.
VOA always delivers your favorite programs, news, music, entertainment, and sports shows. Starting Monday, October 5th, our flagship news show, South Sudan in Focus, will be moving to 16:30 UTC, followed by your favorite sports show, The Sunny Side of Sports, at 1700 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Before we end the show, I have a special announcement for you. This program can now be heard in South Sudan at 7:30 local time on VOA affiliate stations. Please inform your friends and relatives. That's all we prepared for you this Monday. We now leave you with a collaboration from some top South Sudanese musicians singing about rape.
Shock upon the beats. Sibutakum yakam no suwan de umahatakum matakum sabab takarabuhaya de jena taki matakum sabab takarabuhaya tabuba taki bijibu mutu bijibu kore bijibu kerehia bijibu waja bijibu jena wagi buwe
tuta mutubongo nyodoko na kinda lele mutu tina nyowa Why? Rasta akwider karabu, brother gone suicidal. Why repa brother deka anu ita atanu wakumali subdes can never go away. Lepeng this sister nange tubongo oh. Nange bai alula let anabiga marasaki. Why kill a brother's confidence, manhood, mental health and spiritual? Think of him, his family, his future, his dream and his vision.
Matakum sabab, matakum sabab da wajade. Matakum sabab, matakum sabab da wajade.
Matasibu zokere is wajade. Matakum sabab da wajade. Matasibu zokere is wajade.
No media miri, chini, mache chini, pamiri, mate chusu ru, hamba, hamba, ha. Tanadi nyo yenye, mache odrupi miruri, tanadi nyo yenye, mache endra wa miruri.
We've been listening to a collaboration by some top South Sudanese musicians singing about rape. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for being part of our evening. Remember to wash your hands with soap, practice social distancing, and wear a mask if you must leave your house. Do not escape from COVID-19 quarantine centers because there is no cure for coronavirus. Join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
The unspeakable rape, that's horrific to be specific. To you, Mr. Rapist, quick question. Why turn an innocent infant into a rape victim? Well, I've been binge drinking, plus drug addiction, impaired my vision. All of a sudden, I felt possessed by demonic spirits. Then got tempted by the way she was dressing. Added the fact that I'm overly aggressive, selfish, self-possessive. They should strip your ass naked and get you public class straight, you damn rapist.
Matakun sabab, matakun sabab, kawajaje.